Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Kerry pledges new refugee aid for Kenya. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has announced millions of dollars in new aid for Africa at a Monday news conference in Nairobi, Kenya. Kerry said $45 million in additional funding will be provided to help the UNHCR assist 600,000 refugees living in Kenya. He praised Nairobi for taking in the refugees. Earlier, Monday, Kerry honored the victims of the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi and a series of more recent attacks as he pledged Monday that the U.S. will continue supporting the fight against terrorism. Police in Garland, Texas, a Dallas suburb, shot and killed two men who, they said, began shooting at a security officer outside a building where a free speech event was taking place Sunday. The event included a contest for cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad, a visual representation of whom is considered blasphemous by many devout Muslims. VOA's Greg Flakes has more on the story from our Houston bureau.
Officials said in the exchange of gunfire, police say both alleged attackers died and the security officer suffered non-life-threatening wounds. The New York-based American Freedom Defense Initiative sponsored the event, which included an awards ceremony for cartoon depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. In Europe, a number of cartoonists who drew pictures of the Prophet for a Danish publication in 2005 went into hiding after receiving threats. In January, gunmen killed 12 people at the Paris offices of Charlie Hebdo, a satirical French magazine that had printed such cartoons. Greg Flakes, VOA News, Houston.
You are listening to the news coming to you from Washington. Police. The city of Baltimore slowly returned to normal Monday after a citywide curfew ended Sunday after five nights. National Guard troops started to draw down and stores began to reopen. Baltimore was in turmoil last week after the funeral for Freddie Gray, an African-American man who died last month while in police custody. Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake said Sunday she did not want to have the curfew in place longer than necessary. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan said the state of emergency in Baltimore will be lifted once all the 4,000 soldiers and police brought in from other states have left the city. Four more people have been rescued from underneath rubble more than a week after the devastating earthquake in Nepal killed more than 7,200 people. As more international forces, including U.S. Marines, arrive in the country to help with aid efforts. The U.S. will help manage the growing piles of relief supplies clogging Nepal's only international airport in Kathmandu, which is struggling to distribute the aid arriving from around the world since the 7.8 magnitude quake. 10 migrants drowned in the Mediterranean near the coast of Libya over the last few days, but at least 4,800 were rescued as people smugglers took advantage of calm seas to attempt the often perilous crossing to Europe's southern shores. All of those rescued were ferried to Italian ports. Top political leaders from Taiwan and China met for the first time in 6 years and held talks that analysts say are aimed at boosting support for the island's ruling party ahead of key elections early next year. VOA's Bill Eide has more from Beijing.
Zhu arrived in China for the three-day visit on Saturday. The trip has included meetings with ranking Communist Party leaders, a forum between the Nationalist Party and Communist Party, as well as casual discussions with scholars and students at universities in Beijing and Shanghai. On Monday, when Zhu met Communist Party Chief Xi Jinping, he stressed his party's support for eventual unification with China, a key position that has made it possible for the former bitter rivals to meet. Zhu says the younger generation in Taiwan hopes to see the promotion of regional peace, no matter what the activities or organizations might be. Bill Eide, VOA News, Beijing.
Three Republican outsiders are joining the crowded contest for the party's U.S. presidential nomination in 2016. Former technology executive Carly Fiorina said Monday she is running for president, while retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson says he is also entering the race. Another candidate, former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, plans to announce his candidacy Tuesday. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Secretary of State Kerry has laid a wreath at the August 7th memorial in Kenya, the site of the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombing that left more than 200 people dead.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins reporting from Nairobi. Details coming up. Also in the news, Nigeria's military rescues an estimated 700 women and girls held captive by Boko Haram. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Ghana, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Kenyan officials on security, economic development, and the refugee crisis. VOA State Department correspondent Pam Dawkins reports from Nairobi.
Secretary of State Kerry has laid a wreath at the August 7th memorial in Kenya, the site of the 1998 U.S. embassy bombing that left more than 200 people dead. He was joined by an embassy staff member who was on hand when the attack occurred. As Kenyan officials and embassy staff members stood by, he said the only place for Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, Boko Haram, Daesh, and others like them is in the past. He said the future does not belong to them. Later, Kerry met privately with President Uhuru Kenyatta and separately with the country's main opposition leaders, including former Prime Minister Raila Odinga. Heading into his meeting with the opposition leaders, Kerry said his expectations were to listen so that he could be as informed as possible about the challenges that Kenya is facing. One of those challenges involves refugees. Kenya is hosting about 600,000 refugees in three camps. In a background briefing, a senior State Department official said Kerry has been urging the Kenyan government to uphold its obligations to refugees after officials threatened to close one camp that hosts a large Somali population. Pam Dawkins, VOA News, Nairobi.
Kenyans say they are hopeful that this week's visit by U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry will mean greater U.S. support for Kenya's war on terror. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports that security is on everyone's mind following a recent spate of attacks blamed on Al-Shabaab militants.
On the streets of Nairobi, Kenyans are talking about a photograph on page 2 of the People's Daily newspaper. Attached to a story about John Kerry's visit, it shows a heavily armed American soldier in full body armor with an assault rifle in his hands and another sidearm strapped to his leg. Next to him is a Kenyan police officer, seemingly unarmed, in a standard-issue uniform, no body armor, standing with his arms behind his back. For 24-year-old student Sherry Ogola, it is a picture worth a thousand words.
The Kenyan policeman is just plain. It's just the uniform. Basically, it's the uniform that tells he's a policeman. Otherwise, you'd mistake him for a watchman. He doesn't have any sort of protection. Even a gun holder, a simple gun holder, it's a very bad image.
It is just one picture and not truly indicative of the preparation of Kenyan security forces on the whole. But Ogola says it sends a message to Kenya's enemies.
And it's so bad. It shows the level of security we have. And it's so saddening because I'm sure if someone who was planning an attack sees, even if they don't know anything about Kenya, they just see what we have to present, that can really tell them a lot. And those are the loopholes they take advantage of.
Ogola says the Kenyan forces need better equipment and training, and that is where John Kerry comes in. In fact, much of the talk surrounding the diplomatic stopover has focused on what kind of assistance the United States can provide for Kenya's war on terror. The country has suffered numerous attacks blamed on the Al-Qaeda-linked Somali militant group Al-Shabaab in recent years. Lorraine Mumia, a student in Mombasa, is one of many Kenyans still shaken by the group's assault on a university campus in the northeastern town of Garissa in April.
Yeah, personally, I lost a cousin, Garissa Al-Shabaab. I lost a cousin. She had like 5 bullets in her. When we were going to see her in the morgue, I could not even recognize her. So we like really need that addressed. security. We really need that.
That attack left 148 people dead and had many in the country crying out for better security. The U.S. gave about $10 million in direct counterterror support to Kenya in 2014 and has spent hundreds of millions of dollars to help fund and equip the African Union mission in Somalia, known as AMISOM, of which Kenya is a member. Some, however, say Kenya should not be singled out by the United States as a troublesome country.
Terrorism is not a Kenyan problem.
This is Joshua Busire, a surveyor in Nairobi.
Terrorism is a universal problem. Yeah, it's a threat to U.S. itself. It's a threat to most African countries, to Europe, all over the world.
One way or another, Kenya has a security problem. Al-Shabaab has vowed to continue attacks in retaliation for Kenya's military involvement in Somalia. Whether assistance comes from the United States or elsewhere, Kenya could use all the help against terrorism it can get. Gabe Joselo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Far from the Nigerian army campaign against the Boko Haram militants in the north, community leaders in the Central State Plateau have charged government troops with the killings of dozens of civilians and the destruction of villages last Saturday. In a news conference in Jos, the capital of Plateau State, Kamradi Jangle Lobat says he has documented the deaths of at least 38 civilians at the hands of government soldiers. Another local leader said the number of dead was probably more than 80. Lobat claims the military acted in response to the killing and mutilation of six soldiers on April 28th. The tribal leader says those deaths were probably the work of cattle rustlers from the Tarok tribes of Wase District. Captain Akdechi Esseya of the government's special task force says they are currently engaged in firefights with militiamen and have not targeted any civilians. Conflicts between Christian farmers and Muslim semi-nomadic cattle herders have led to thousands of deaths in the Plateau State in recent years. Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, was rocked by a new wave of protests Monday against President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a third term. Protesters are vowing to continue the street demonstrations until the president changes his mind. Mohamed Yusuf has more on the story from Bujumbura.
Hundreds of Burundian protesters sang the national anthem in unison as anti-riot police watched. Protesters carried placards with slogans such as No to Violence and Respect the Arusha Accord and the Constitution. Police once again blocked protesters from marching to the city centre, so the demonstrators instead blocked streets with stones and lit bonfires. Thick smoke could be seen billowing in the skies over the capital. The demonstration resumed after a two-day break. Some protests began as early as 6 in the morning. The presence of police on nearly every street of the capital did not stop demonstrators from expressing their views. This student said he will keep protesting until President Pierre Nkurunziza withdraws his bid for a new term. I've come here to express what is in my heart, he says. I am against the President Nkurunziza's third term bid. We don't want him. He must leave. If he won't, we also won't leave the streets. One of the protest organizers say police are using too much force against them. We are not happy with the behaviors of our police, he says. We are here on a respectable activity, and they are firing live bullets at us. They are armed with guns and tear gas, and we are not armed with anything. According to a civil society group, at least 9 people have been killed since the protest began last week. Some protesters say they are scared that Nkurunziza's militiamen are recording who participates in the demonstrations and plan future retribution. Those are militias allied to the president, and they are dressed as police officers. We know them, he says. That one was taking pictures. You see, he's running away. They take pictures and later they come to kill us. We are against such behaviors. The unrest began on April 26th after President Nkurunziza announced his bid to run for a third term, a move that critics say violates the constitution and the 2000 Arusha Accord that helped end Burundi's civil war. Mr. Nkurunziza came to power in 2005. His supporters insist he is allowed to run again because he was elected to his first term by parliament, not directly by voters. The protests have raised fears Burundi could descend into civil war again. Burundi's top military chief, Prime Niyangabo, told reporters Sunday night that the army would not intervene with the political process. The military is taking this opportunity and warning those who want to use the military on political issues. In using the military on political issues, it will break the law and its professional conduct, he says. I would like to urge all the troops, wherever they are, to be calm and united against those who want to use them for political goals. Most of the businesses remain closed and more streets were deserted Monday. Police say they have arrested at least 600 people since the protests erupted last week. Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Bujumbura.
Ethnic tensions are rising in Israel after a protest by Ethiopian Jews against alleged racism and discrimination turned violent. The riots were sparked by a video showing police beating an Israeli soldier of Ethiopian origin. Robert Berger has the story from Jerusalem.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met with Ethiopian Jewish leaders and appealed for calm after protests against alleged police brutality and racism turned violent. Hundreds of Ethiopian Israelis blocked the main highway Sunday in Tel Aviv. Then they threw stones and bottles at police, who responded with stun grenades. There was a similar riot in Jerusalem last week. The violence erupted after the airing of a video showing police beating an Israeli soldier of Ethiopian origin. Ethiopian activist Solomon Shimon says it was an unprovoked act of racism.
We all of us say enough is enough. This situation, it's happening everywhere, anytime, and we want to stop it. And we want freedom, we want equality.
Prime Minister Netanyahu met with the soldier who was beaten and expressed regret. He said he was shocked by the beating and his government is working to change the situation. But the Ethiopian community is skeptical. There are about 120,000 Ethiopian Jews in Israel, a small minority in a country of 8 million. And while the Israeli government brought them here in two major airlifts in 1984 and 1991, they have never felt quite welcome. Ethiopian Jews say they suffer from police brutality, racism, and discrimination in Israel because of the color of their skin. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
And in news from Nigeria, the Nigerian military has been encouraged by the rescue of an estimated 700 women and girls held captive by the extremists. More than 230 of the women and girls are receiving medical support since their rescue. They are being held at an abandoned school at Malakua refugee camp next to a military barracks in the city of Yola in Adamawa State. One of the girls told the Associated Press Wire Service she witnessed other hostages being stoned to death by Boko Haram fighters as the militants escaped advancing government forces. She said when they refused to leave with their captors, they were stoned. According to the statement by the girl, she held her baby to her stomach and doubled over to protect the child. She said several died of the stonings. Others who had been hiding in shrubs were accidentally run over by a Nigerian military personnel carrier. All of them died. Major General Chris Olukolade today expressed confidence that the military campaign against Boko Haram will succeed. However, he said, the pace has been slowed by landmines that the terrorists have planted around their camps. You are listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Twenty-one past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Kenyan officials in Nairobi on security, economic development, and the refugee crisis. And Nigerian military rescues an estimated 700 women and girls held captive by Boko Haram extremists. The international organization Save the Children released a report today that reveals global rankings of the best and worst places to be a mother. The State of the World's Mothers 2015 study focuses on child survival and reveals the growing divide between urban wealthy mothers and urban poor mothers around the world. For example, Norway rose to the top of the list and Somalia remains last for a second year in a row. David Oot is senior advisor for health and nutrition for Save the Children. He spoke with reporter Kim Lewis about the challenges poor African moms face living in urban areas.
This particular report this year focused specifically on the challenges facing mothers and children in urban settings, and particularly urban poor settings. And those are similar in many ways, but in other ways are different. For example, access to clean water and sanitation, security, decent housing are all unique challenges, particularly for mothers who are living in urban slums, and that happens to be where the bulk of urban populations in sub-Saharan Africa do live.
How can these moms living in these types of areas and conditions be properly supported?
Well, for sure, they need better access to basic services, and that includes particularly preventive and curative health services for themselves, their newborns, and their children. And those are often, strangely enough, not available. Or if they are, they tend to be more available in the private sector. And many mothers, in fact, especially poor mothers, can't afford that care from private providers. So in the first instance, they need to be able to access that service. The second is that in many cases, the access to basic services such as water and sanitation is either unavailable or it requires a great deal of time and effort to actually access clean water, for example.
Are there any countries, though, that are working that you found out that they are making progress in terms of survival rates for their children?
Overall, there are a number of African countries that have made significant progress in reducing under 5 death rates since 1990. 3 of those countries that have actually gotten on track, as it were, to meet Millennium Development Goal 4 of reducing under 5 deaths by 2/3 are Ethiopia, Malawi, and Rwanda, with Ethiopia and Malawi actually having already met that goal. And they've done that by doing a variety of things, ensuring that women actually deliver with a skilled birth attendant present, that they achieve and sustain high rates of immunization coverage, that there's improved access and use of treatment for diseases such as pneumonia, malaria, and where exclusive breastfeeding has been encouraged and supported. In urban settings, and particularly for the urban poor, one of the best examples is Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And this is quite remarkable. The gap actually has declined by almost half. That is the gap between the richest and poorest with respect to under-5 mortality. And under-5 mortality itself has been reduced by over 50% between the year 2000 and 2011. And there are a variety of steps that they took, actions that they took to achieve that remarkable success, including increasing the number of primary care facilities, making services like family planning and immunization more widely available, increasing the number of nurses available to actually provide care.
Do you think enough focus is being placed on the emotional and mental health of a mom, especially those living in poor urban areas?
Save the Children as an organization has been seeking to address this issue both in rural and urban settings in a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world. And first of all, it is challenging and it's neglected, and it becomes in many ways even more challenging in urban slum settings, where some of the support systems that might have existed in rural communities where people would have lived or they've moved from often are not present in those urban poor settings. So it is a neglected area and more needs to be done. And I would say we've also, Save the Children has initiated a number of rather innovative programs that are also intended to get boys and men much more engaged. That is one of the challenges in sub-Saharan Africa. To be successful, you really need the engagement of men as well as moms in trying to address both their needs and the needs of their children.
David Oot, he's Senior Advisor for Health and Nutrition for Save the Children. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Arlington, Virginia. This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. It's 27 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the African Union declared 2015 the year of women's empowerment in acknowledgement of the increasing role women are playing in Africa's development. We'll introduce you to women from the African diaspora who will share their personal stories on empowering themselves and their sisters on the continent for Africa's future. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting with Kenyan officials on security, economic development, and the refugee crisis. And ethnic tensions are rising in Israel after a protest by Ethiopian Jews turns violent. Coming up, music from Ghana, and in our feature segment, families of autistic children in Kenya are lobbying for better laws and support to overcome the stigma and lack of awareness. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahyas Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is African News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. It's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. And happy Monday, Sunny.
Happy Monday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I hear you are tipping off with a basketball award.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to sharpshooting Golden State Warriors guard Stephen Curry, who on Monday was named the National Basketball Association's Most Valuable Player. The 27-year-old Curry will be presented with the MVP trophy Tuesday night when the Warriors host the Memphis Grizzlies in Game 2 of the Western Conference semifinal playoff series. Curry scored 22 points and had 7 assists Sunday as the Warriors won Game 1 in the best-of-seven series, 101-86. The top-seeded Warriors were coming off a 4-game sweep of the New Orleans Pelicans in the first round of the NBA playoffs that earned them an 8-day layoff. The NBA's most valuable player, Stephen Curry, comments.
How we started the first half coming off that long week, this is the first experience of having a rest in between series, so we stayed sharp in all our downtime and came out aggressive on both ends of the floor. And when you get off to a good start, you build your confidence and you kind of roll from there. We're a deep team. I mean, you don't win, six, seven games without contributions from everybody. So for us to, our bench to come in and play the way they did, we're going to be good if everybody steps up, is ready for the moment, and we play our hearts out.
During the regular season, Stephen Curry averaged almost 24 points per game as the Warriors won a club record 67 games. Steph also broke his own NBA record by making 286 three-point shots during the regular season. I wrote about Curry in February in my Sunny Side of Sports blog, saying how for every three-point shot he makes during games, the new MVP donates 3 insecticide-treated mosquito nets to the Nothing But Nets anti-malaria campaign. Steph Curry is the first Warriors player to be named the league's most valuable player since the late, great Wilt Chamberlain, who won the award during the 1959-1960 NBA season when the club was based in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In Sunday's other NBA playoff game, my beloved Washington Wizards clipped the wings of the host Atlanta Hawks 104-98 in Game 1 of the Eastern Conference semifinals. Bradley Beal scored a game-high 28 points for the Wizards. Beal also sprained his ankle late in the fourth quarter, and his status for Game 2 on Tuesday night in Atlanta is not clear.
They're playing basketball. We love that basketball.
It's time to climb between the ropes once again with our reigning prince of pugilistics, Nnamdi Hollywood Moeta. Good evening, Nnamdi.
And a good evening, Sonny.
Floyd Mayweather remains unbeaten. 48th victory in a row. Unanimous decision over Manny Pacquiao in the fight of the century. First off, Nnamdi, I posted some photos at my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page, just dumbfounded at some of the reaction, saying Pac-Man was robbed and that the match was fixed. Did they watch the same fight that you and I watched?
Sonny, still undefeated. Still a cash machine. I remember your old friend, the late Angelo Dundee. Floyd Mayweather did a number on Manny Pacquiao and made him look stupid. Buck circles around Manny Pacquiao.
Lots of question marks after the fight, Namdi. The Pac-Man basically making some excuses, saying that he injured his right shoulder in training.
2 weeks before the fight and 1 week before the fight, it's my shoulder is getting better and better, but not really 100%, totally 100%, recover, but at least I can use it, but something wrong.
Well, then why didn't they postpone the fight if he's not healthy?
Sonny Manny Pacquiao and Freddie Roach both are sore losers, you know. I went to Wild Kite Gym before the fight. I watched him. And on this show, Sonny, I told our listeners that this cat is not ready. All this excuse, shoulder injury, he didn't even talk about the calf muscles, you know, and all that stuff. A sore loser, he should be ashamed of himself. This is his last payday.
For my two cents, Namdi, when you get into the ring for a fight that's been hyped that much, you better come to fight.
Yeah, he didn't do nothing, you know. Mayweather, we expected a masterful technician Saturday night, and he delivered. Manny Pacquiao and Freddie Roach, you wonder what they were doing in training camp. You know, they were busy dealing with Hollywood celebrities, making all this appearance in Jimmy Kimmel's show. They had no plan B. I mean, if you remember, we talked about adjustments in fights, you know. Manny Pacquiao was just like driving a car in one gear. You know what's going to happen. You burn up the clutch, mess up the car. Floyd was able to adjust. And if you remember when we talked Friday, we talked about Floyd Mayweather putting the early rounds in the bag, putting it in the bank. And that's exactly what he did and frustrated Manny Pacquiao.
Were there turning points in the fight where you thought he's got it, he's dominating this fight, and it's over?
After the first five rounds, you know, all these haters were the people that made him rich, you know, because they paid a lot of money to see him get knocked out, see him bloodied. But this man kept banking. When he's said and done, he's going to walk away with close to $350 million for one night's work. So you can hate him as much as you want. He will go down in boxing as the best, you know. I even got a call from Lagos last night chewing me out about what I said on Muhammad Ali and Floyd Mayweather. And they said that the motor park fights in Lagos is more exciting. And I told them that, look, dude, the motor park fights knows nothing about defense. It's all offense.
And yet, I think you're right, Namdi. I think so many fans wanted this brawl between Pacquiao and Mayweather, but Mayweather just won't allow that type of fight.
Sonny, these fans paid for toe-to-toe, but we in the game, we saw this long time ago that there'll be no toe-to-toe. There'll be no Maidana-style one fight. It's going to be a fight with the smartest man in the ring with the smartest corner, and that's exactly what happened. Personally, me and you, we did not expect him to go there and look stupid and come out with bruised nose or broken jaw. No, Mayweather is too smart and too slick. He out-hustled Manny Pacquiao.
Two of the critics after the fight, Namdi, former champions Mike Tyson and Oscar De La Hoya, they both called it a boring fight. Your reaction?
These two guys are jealous because Floyd Mayweather, one night payday, is way better than what they made in their lifetime. They're jealous of Manny Mayweather, and they will still be jealous until he will go ahead and break Rocky Marciano's record, and they will still be jealous.
There's still some thought, though, Namdi, that Mayweather might hang up the gloves after September. He said post-fight that he'll fight one more time. It'll be a non-title fight.
Monday, I'm going to relinquish all belts. You know, Monday, you know, I made a decision in the back that my last fight may not be a championship fight. I'm going to give up all the belts. It's still going to be a 12-round fight, but I'm going to relinquish all the belts Monday.
You think that's just smoke at this point?
That's just smoke, Sonny. He will do two. One in September, and then the next one, the final one, he will open the brand new arena at the MGM. There'll be a brand new arena, and Floyd Mayweather will open the arena, and that'll be the last fight, and that will be the record fight where he will be 50-0, breaking Rocky Marciano's record. Forget about him retiring in September. He will retire after he destroyed Rocky Marciano's record, open the brand new arena at MGM Grand. Take that to the bank, Sonny. I'm saying that from what I know.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moueta. And we'll hear more verbal jabs from Namdi about Mayweather Pacquiao later this week, right here on the Sunny Side of Sports. Turning to African athletics, the Candy Man, Felix Candy of Kenya, scored a sweet victory over the weekend at the Volkswagen Prague Marathon in the Czech Republic. Felix clocked 2 hours, 8 minutes, and 32 seconds. The energetic Andy Edwards caught up with Felix after his triumph. Here's Andy.
We're talking with the winner of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon 2015, and that is Felix Candy, who's having a great last few months of the marathon. He won the tough Athens Marathon last November, set a course record, and here really beat a strong field. Felix, did you realize that you were in that kind of shape when you came to Prague?
Yeah, when I came to Prague, I knew I had well preparation, as I was training well in Kenya, so I was expecting to do a marvelous job here. But as I arrived here, I felt a little bit sick. I had some flu. So since the other day, even last night, I was doubting. I say maybe I will try and run position 5 if it's worse, because I felt bad through the night. But I thank God, because during when I woke up in the morning, I felt a little bit better. And I said I'm going to try and push and maybe run a good position.
Well, you've run a personal best by around 2 minutes, or just under 2 minutes. What about getting your time under 2 hours, 8 minutes? Is that the next objective, to run sub 2:08?
Yes, that was even my next objective, as I was saying maybe I could have run here also maybe 2:06, but due to my condition that changed the previous 2 days, so it led me to didn't make it to run as I had earlier planned.
Well, you certainly made a very speedy recovery from that virus and won the Volkswagen Prague Marathon. Felix Candy of Kenya, congratulations. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, energetic Andy Edwards. Speaking there with Kenyan athlete Felix Candy, the 2015 Volkswagen Prague Marathon champion. If you're just tuning in now to the Voice of America, my top story, Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors, was on Monday named the most valuable player in the National Basketball Association. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up in Kenya, families of autistic children lobbying for better laws to overcome stigma. And next, computer science students in South Sudan developing new phone applications. But first, some music. Here is Roki Duwani of Ghana with the Master Plan.
Favorite drum.
people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Come on, people, meditate, go higher. Ghana people, make you take it, go higher. Come Africa, make you light my fire. And I'll be proud. I could not believe the news today. Another hero falls in South Africa. Wipe your tears and fears away. All you children from Africa, Jamaica. Sing new songs of joy and redemption. Wave your flags in celebration. Come on, people, lift up your heart. Now that you have seen the light, we must sing this song with one great voice. Surviving the master plan. Surviving, surviving now. Surviving, surviving now.
If the future knew I'm so, then we too, we go to our table higher. So then we too, we go move up, take go higher.
Surviving the master plan.
If they fit to pass up, so then we too, we go pass up, take go higher.
Surviving the master plan.
If they fit to move up, so then we too, we go move up, take go higher.
Surviving the master plan.
Surviving.
Rocky Duwani of Ghana with the master plan.
Well, a new U.S. study shows that 1 in 68 children around the world are autistic. In Kenya, families of autistic children are lobbying for better laws and support to overcome stigma and a lack of awareness. From Nairobi, Lenny Ruvaga has this report.
These are the Manyaras. Today, Grace Manyara is escorting her son, 23-year-old John Manyara, to work. John is autistic, a developmental disability that can cause significant social, communication, and behavioral challenges. Autospectrum disorder, ASD, affects 1 in 68 children worldwide, according to the United States Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC. In Kenya, statistics haven't been quantified on the number of those affected by the disability. John is one of the few autistic youths in Kenya who engage in gainful employment. He works at Karatasi Yahewa Safi, or Kahesa, which when translated means eco-friendly paper. 3 years ago, Simia Ahmadi began Kahesa with her personal savings of $12,000. Her staff makes handmade paper from banana bark and rice husks, which she then sells at exhibitions, schools and trade fairs. On average, Kahesa makes approximately $500 a month, which is then used to pay the workers and buy materials. Ahmadi began Kahesa with the sole aim of generating income for young adults with mental challenges.
I hope that after 2015, they will be integrated into a regular professional field so that they are now included in the workforce and not isolated. Because once they have the vocational training here, they should not stop at that. They must fly with their own wings afterwards.
Grace Manyara runs a cyber cafe in Nairobi. For 10 years, she struggled with the lack of awareness in how to manage autism. According to her, stigma is the biggest challenge that is yet to be overcome.
It's a hidden disability, so there's nothing to show that he has a disability. So there's a lot of stigma. There are others who think that the child is bewitched, kurogwa in our language, and which is not the case. It's a manageable disability if it is handled well.
James Karanja is the founder of the Autism Support Center Kenya. He notes that the government has neglected the plight of those with autism and should do more to reduce the stigma attached to autism.
We need increased funding to institutions that offer training for persons working with those on the autism spectrum. And these are the teachers, specialized teachers, medical personnel, we need therapists, and also bringing more awareness. So it's actually the government who should be at the forefront to bring more awareness so that the stigma and all these other issues affecting those with autism are reduced.
Although the Kenyan government cares for the disabled through the National Disability Fund, those with autism aren't looked after as closely as they should be. It is hoped that with more pressure from lobbying, the Kenyan government will accord ASD the strengthened policy and interventions it deserves. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Computer science students in South Sudan are developing new phone applications that are designed to make it easier and faster to share important information with a smartphone. From Juba University, Jacob Aishik sent this report.
The applications were created and developed by 43 students with support from the United Nations Educational Organization, UNESCO, and Zain Telecommunication. The course is part of a global initiative launched by UNESCO to help young people develop mobile applications that drive development and improve information sharing. Pitya David is a trainer from the College of Computer Science at Juba University.
We have a program that's known as Youths Mobile. It's an initiative of UNESCO. A Youth Mobile is a program that intends to train South Sudanese youth so that they will be able to develop mobile applications. Mobile applications are applications that can be installed in our phones, mainly smartphones, so that we can have locally produced applications to serve our local need.
David says training session in app development began in August last year.
In this training, we help to develop the student capacity further so that they are able to build more applications. So far, in the intermediate training, the student managed to come up with 6 applications that were prototyped. We presented them during the closing ceremony of the training, and we tested the work very well, only that we need to take them further.
Taban Bosco is one of the participants in the Youth Mobile Initiative. He developed an application for first aid. He says altogether he and his fellow students have developed 6 different applications.
There's application for literacy, there's application for first aid, there's application for traffic lights, there's even application for peace message exchanger, or we can call it Risal al-Salam. Then there's also application of geographical location. For those who don't know South Sudan in general, they can use that application for them to locate all the 10 states in South Sudan.
24-year-old Emmanuel Lamoro developed an application for crop production. Lamoro says his application is aiming at helping farmers to get advice on cultivation from far away production centers. He says the mobile application will help to create jobs and generate money for South Sudan.
In the country, we see that if this initiative is extended to all the 10 states, it will reduce the rate of reliance because most of youth, they don't know what to do, and others are crying of no jobs, there's no money. This application also, on the other hand, will generate money for the youth and will keep youths busy. In fact, different applications solve the problem of the country, not only in crop production area, but in different areas, so that make youths committed and then they will be thinking of what to do actually for the country.
David says Zain Telecommunication is trying to get U.S. internet giant Google to recognize South Sudan application developers. UN South Sudanese developers to be able to host their application on Google for smartphone users around the world to download. David says South Sudanese smartphone users can already download the applications. For BOA News, I'm Jacob Acek in Juba.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
10 years ago, the administration of then-President George W. Bush launched the President's Malaria Initiative, or PMI, a $1.2 billion program that aimed to reduce by half deaths from malaria in 15 of the hardest-hit countries in Africa. In 2008, the program was expanded to 19 African countries and the Greater Mekong subregion. Over the past decade, working through this initiative, the United States and its partners have helped the target countries make significant strides toward controlling malaria. PMI coordinator Rear Admiral Timothy Zimmer and Global HIV/AIDS coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx, MD, wrote recently in a blog that the contributions of PMI, together with those of other partners, have dramatically improved coverage of key malaria control interventions, including use of insecticide-treated mosquito nets, indoor residual spraying, accurate diagnosis and prompt treatment, and intermittent preventative treatment of pregnant women. Indeed, according to the World Health Organization, since 2001, malaria deaths have decreased by 47% globally. That's over 4 million lives spared. Most of that progress has taken place since 2005. Still, according to the WHO, in 2013 alone, malaria sickened some 198 million people and killed 584,000 of them. Clearly, more needs to be done. The 2005 President's Malaria Initiative expires at the end of this year, and so the administration of President Barack Obama has formulated a new plan that will take us through 2020. The new strategy begins with the ultimate goal of eliminating malaria everywhere. To get us started over the next 5 years, we will work with our partners to reduce malaria mortality in PMI countries by one-third from today's levels. That means malaria levels 80% lower than they were in 2000. We will also work to reduce the occurrence of malaria within PMI populations by 40% from today's levels and help at least five PMI-supported countries to meet the World Health Organization criteria for pre-elimination. There is no greater joy than knowing children, mothers, and communities are thriving because malaria no longer ravages villages, wrote program coordinators Zimmer and Birx. America's result-driven global health assistance saves and improves lives, reduces long-term health costs, and lays the foundation for sustainable development in the world's poorest countries.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, the African Union declared 2015 the year of women's empowerment in acknowledgement of the increasing role women are playing in Africa's development. We'll introduce you to women from the African diaspora who will share their personal stories on empowering themselves and their sisters on the continent for Africa's future. That's Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.